the things that we do shape us into the people we become. So they have become because of the work that they do. And it's really not the work itself, by the way. It's the way in which we do the work that shapes us into the people we become.
Yeah.
So I think oftentimes we have unthought lives because it's easy. It's easier to have a life in which I'm not really thinking about what is it costing me to be this person? What am I sacrificing as a result of the choices that I'm making? What does it mean that I'm out of alignment with my values? No, we're not thinking any of that because I think to a certain extent, my main message, we think we have no choices.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We think we have choices. And oftentimes I'm talking to people who have golden handcuffs. And so it doesn't make any sense to retire because I'm going to lose some of my retirement benefits if I do this. And I have a family, and there's lots and lots of real reasons why people behave and engage in the things that they engage with. But I always still say that underneath all of that, you don't have to do it that way.
Hard work, work.
Hard work. That's what they say.
Hard work, work.
Hard work. I earn my pay.
Hard work, work.
Hard work. Do it every day.
Well, welcome once again to another Work Ethic. I am really excited about today's episode. I'm here with Sandy Brown, who is a master certified coach. I had a opportunity to meet Sandy recently to do a session with her, but also just to meet her through a class that I took actually on social enterprise with St. Leo's University. And she was made available to us as a kind of leadership coach throughout that process, and was really excited to make this connection. And as we were talking through one of the classes, I heard Sandy drop a little nugget that hinted at a real philosophy of work. And I was like, oh, I want to get her on. But just off the kind of top line, looks like Sandy was a co-author of a book called The Inspired Journey, A Woman's Blueprint to Spirit-Filled Living, that was published back in 2005. And then I guess you have a little radio interview experience. It looks like she co-hosted actually an internet radio show based on that book later in 2008. Then has just decades of experience with management consulting with organizations through culture change, leadership development, executive and leadership coaching, worked with companies like Harley Davidson, Northwest Mutual. It looks like lots of school districts actually as well. And I'm sure there's plenty more to the story. This is literally just right off of the LinkedIn. But I'm going to go ahead and toss you the ball to kind of introduce yourself to everybody, however you would like to frame yourself. And then we're just going to wrap from there.
I just love that. So you should know this. Anytime somebody says, well, tell me a little about yourself, the first thing that happens outwardly or inwardly, hopefully more inwardly than outwardly, my eyes roll back in my head, right? Because I think the question really is, who are you? And in my universe, that is the deepest question we can be asking of others and of ourselves. Mm. And so, who am I? And then after that, my next question, usually I toss back to the person and say, what exactly is it that you want to know? Right? Because so then I would toss this back to you. However, I know that you're trying to get me to say some stuff, so I'm not going to toss it back to you. I'm actually going to engage in this notion of the question of who am I, because I am very curious about what is it that people really want to know about us as individuals, because my titles, my work, none of that necessarily informs who I am, because you get no sense of journey or anything. I also know that as an African-American woman, if I walk into a room, people already think they know who I am, even though they, and they think they know my journey. So I find it fascinating that how we make up stories about people already, either from what we see or what we hear, even hearing my voice now, whoa, who is this person, right? So I don't know what's important to say about who I am, other than to say something like this. One of my favorite stories is about Gandhi, who was rushing to get to his next destination, and He was in a big hurry, and he was in the process of, you know, getting onto a train when somebody yelled, "Gandhi, Gandhi, tell us about you. Who are you?" And he said, essentially, "My life is my message." And I love that, because before I knew that story, I was saying the same thing. So that means I'm as wise as Gandhi. Not really.
Clearly. Not really.
Clearly. But I was saying the same thing, because when I look back over my core message of anything that's at the foundation of my coaching work is the notion that we all have a choice. And this is a hard notion for people to grasp, that we have a choice about how we experience our life. So who I am is someone who is in the process of waking up to who I really am, my truest nature, and growing up, which would mean to align myself with my values and what I say is important in life. So I would say my work informs who I am, and it's really all about helping people find their own power in life. Now, I do want to say this. Early in life, when I was 25, that was 45 years ago, I participated in a self-actualization program that was pretty controversial at the time. But one of the things we looked at is, you know, what's important, like what was this program about for me? And at that time in my life, I was lost and really just completely broken down as a human being. I was moderately functional. It looked like I was functional on the outside, but on the inside, I was not doing well. And as a participant in this program, that's where I actually woke up, because the thing I realized, coming from a life of abuse, you know, physical and emotional and sexual abuse, I realized that I had been defining myself as a victim in the world. I wasn't so much around being African American, but really as a result of the circumstances of my life, all I could see was how life had done me wrong, so to speak. And so as a victim, that really made me feel as if I had no choices in life, that I didn't even think about the notion that I had any power or the notion that I had any choice about anything. And the primary message in there was, you have a choice about how you experience life. It's all up to you. And that completely changed my life in the sense that I stopped identifying myself as a victim and began more to see that I have power, and where do I exercise that power, and how do I live life from the perspective that how I see things and how I be in life is really up to me. But there's a caveat to that, because at some point I hit an existential wall. Because if it's all up to me and my life sucks, I got nowhere to go. And the question that folded back in on me, because my life then became difficult after that. I had to go to therapy after that because I just had this huge existential crash. Because I'm like, if this is up to me, why is my life looking the way that it looks? And I was stuck and bereft on that for quite a few years. Part of my journey is as a recovering person, and I've been in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction since 1985. So that's a pretty long time. But up to that point, even though I got this, my life is my choice, I was still, you know, abusing alcohol because I really wasn't healed. I wasn't well. So in the process of, you know, going through therapy and going through drug and alcohol treatment, I had another awakening, which said this: yes, I do have a choice about how I view my life. I do have a choice about how I identify myself in the world. However, what I also recognized is that I am in partnership with something greater than myself. And I hesitate to use the word God, because we have so many different notions of God, and we have religions that tell us about God and this and that, but that's sort of the truth. So it is God for me, but I also call it, you know, my relationship with the universe. And one of the orientations I have come away with is that the universe is always conspiring to serve me, to be my highest and best self. So it's up to me to look at how I interpret the things that happen to me. And it's also up to me to be in partnership with that which is greater than me. So I don't have to worry about things all the time. I can let go of things. I can surrender. I can forgive. I can do lots of things if I come from the orientation that it's all meant to be of service to me. So that's who I am.
What a setup. This is so great. So I'm going to rattle off some things I heard, and then we'll kind of go back and see if we can't pick through some of those thematically. So, you know, you kind of said like my work at early on, you said my work does not define, you know, I'm not into the titles and the work. It doesn't define who I am. But a little bit later, talking about your work, you're like, but my work informs who I am. So I'm interested in those two things held next to each other. And then the idea that we have a choice of how we experience things. So there, by the way, that was, I guess, tying the, I'll just name it, identity and work. Like those two things seem really important and something I'd like to explore more. Yeah. And then the idea of freedom, right? We have a, like, I was identifying myself as a victim, but I came to realize we have a choice. And so this kind of like sense of power and agency. Then you went and as you talked about recovery, I was still drinking because it was my choice. And I was thinking about interesting addiction and freedom. Like that's an interesting thing to hold up next to each other. Like I'm free, so I'll be an addict. Well, that's an interesting thing because really I'll be a captive at some level. And then you said, well, then I'm, and then through that process, I realized I'm in partnership with a power greater than myself, with something greater than myself. So there's a bunch of building blocks there. And so we can kind of meander through these, however we want. I think the one that stood out to me, the based on the first thing you said, was this thing around work and identity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know, for example, my father-in-law was just in town and, he retired in, is longer than I've been alive. He was at the same place, kind of running the show of this hospital, this network of hospitals. He was like the maintenance, not maintenance, like the construction manager. He was overall maintenance, overall facilities of this network of hospitals. Big dog. And he retired. And then he had also been a captain of a fire department, which he had retired last year. So he was captain of a volunteer fire department. And then he was like chief of this big network of hospitals. And then he retired in February and he visited and he's like, hey, I want, you know, I'm retired now. He's actually going to work with us on doing some renovation stuff on our house over the next couple of years. Cause he needs something to do. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's exciting. And he's capable. And one of the comments he made while he was here, was like, what did he say? It stuck with me. He's like, I'm not used to being a has been. Or something like that. And I could see clearly this like identity struggle that he was having. And then once upon a time, I personally just took, I guess what you'd call a sabbatical. I just, you know, been in the game for a while. I was like, man, I took a summer and I went, I don't know if you know the Catholic workers, but I went and stayed with a Catholic worker community up in Philadelphia and Kensington and Philly. To just not to really work, but I did work. I volunteered with them, but like not in leadership, just like I'm the guy carrying boxes, no big deal. And most of the time was free as like I spent several months. It was very good for me. But I realized when I got there, like, oh, this is actually really hard. Like there, how much of our identity is tied with our work. So that immediately jumped out as you're like, my work does not define who I am. It does inform who I am. And I want to toss this back to you with a little bit of my own understanding context of the way these are tied together. About our, you know, like one of the things I'm interested in exploring on the work ethic is our relationship to work. Mm-hmm. And what deep, you said the deepest of questions is who are you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we ask little kids, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Not what kind of person you want to be or who you want to be, but we mean what you do. And so let's start picking at that. I see you nodding. So there's plenty there to work with.
Well, there is. I think there is plenty there to work with. And in my work as a coach, I'm working with a lot, you know, a lot of people are my age these days and are retiring. And so, and they've been doing whatever they've been doing for a long, long time.
Yeah.
in education. And they are suffering in a sense because they know that it's time to retire for whatever it is that tells us that. And they have been doing superintendencying for so long, for example, that they don't know what to do next. And of course, you heard me say this. You know, the things that we do shape us into the people we become. So they have become because of the work that they do. And it's really not the work itself, by the way, it's the way in which we do the work. that shapes us into the people we become.
Yeah.
So I think oftentimes we have unthought lives because it's easy. It's easier to have a life in which I'm not really thinking about what is it costing me to be this person? What am I sacrificing as a result of the choices that I'm making? What does it mean that I'm out of alignment with my values? No, we're not thinking any of that because I think to a certain extent, my main message, we think we have no choices.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We think we have choices. And oftentimes I'm talking to people who have golden handcuffs. And so it doesn't make any sense to retire because I'm going to lose some of my retirement benefits if I do this. And I have a family, and there's lots and lots of real reasons why people behave and engage in the things that they engage with. But I always still say that underneath all of that, you don't have to do it that way. Except it's easier to do it that way. We don't have to think about it. If I just go to do a job and don't think about it, don't even think about the fact that I'm not going to be able to do this for until I'm 100 or however long people want to live. At some point, I got to exit. We don't think about that, just like we don't think about death. We live life as if we're always going to be, you know, doing this and healthy, and I'm just going to keep at it, right? And we don't think about the things that are real dynamics in our lives. But anyway, I've probably strayed away from the point, and I want to get back to this. Yes, I think that how we do our work is what shapes us into the people that we become. And so I am a coach, we know that, but I say this, it doesn't matter that it's at this point, I believe that life is about, let me stop myself because I had a train, and my train was this. When you really think about work, what is the work? We don't think about this. What is the work? And so what is the work? There's a notion that says the world is empty and meaningless, because it is. If you really think about it, the only thing that's going on in our lives really is stuff happens, period. Stuff happens. And then we make it mean something. So in life, really, if we step back, we could see that the world really is empty and meaningless. And the only thing that makes it vibrant is the meaning we bring to it. The meaning we bring to it. So maybe, perhaps, work has a lot to do with finding a sense of meaning and purpose in a thoughtful way, in an intentional way, as opposed to an unthought way. So that when we get to the end of it, we have become who we are meant to become by choice and not because of habits that we've engaged in that now have us feel lost in the world.
That's so good. That's, man. So like the way that we go about the things we're doing shape who we become. One stands out to me is like, okay, well, acknowledging that we are in the process of becoming something, like that the choices that we are making, whether we know that we're making them or not, right? Going, oh, I'm just going with these, the way it's supposed to be, or these golden handcuffs, or the things that were seemingly determined for me, or choosing to do those is becoming something, right? And then you're saying, like, it's interesting, like, that our work is tied up, like, because we're choosing to bring meaning through the work, like, as in, I guess, like, the word that comes to mind is like taking responsibility. So like the things that we choose to latch onto or invest in or sacrifice for are like somehow tied to the things that shape or bring meaning to our lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, and somehow that might be connected to our sense of identity.
Yes. Well,
or born out of. Maybe.
I don't think it's born out of our sense of identity, actually, because if you look at a child, they don't really, they're open. I was listening to Jerome Miller, you and Jerome Miller talk. And
love that dude. You did listen. Yeah. That's good.
I did listen. Of course I did. And children are open. They are open. And then we pound them into some shape. Look, you got to figure out, and by the way, I swear, I don't know how anybody does this because I couldn't do it. By the way, when you're 18 and you go to college, if you go to college, you're going to have to figure out who you're going to be and what you're going to do for the rest of your life. It's 20. Come on.
Right.
But we make it that way. We don't say go out and we and parents, you know, we want to save our children. We don't say go out and explore and take your time and you know, it'll come, allow the future to emerge. We don't say that. We say path and stick to it. So I think work is can be, and for many people is an evolutionary journey. How do I evolve past the labels, the expectations, the society that says I need to be and do in this box? How do I evolve outside of that? And I can tell you the reason why people don't is because it's lonely and uncomfortable. It's lonely and uncomfortable to be unique in this world.
That's right. Oh, that's really, yeah, it's really interesting. So like the because we there's an interesting, I don't know how to articulate that. Like, and I'm really glad you brought up Jerome Miller. By the way, he's always really challenged me in this exact way, because this ultimate vulnerability that he talks about, this wild extreme openness, which I'm in full agreement with in theory. And then at the
Really?
same time though, but yet at same time, there's like this dance between that and doing and will and choosing. And there is like, but at some level, there is a choosing to open the door to the stranger. That is a decision that we make, which at some level is like you talk about. Well, it's like facing death. The way Jerome Miller would put it is like to open the door to the stranger is to choose to die at some level, because God only knows what's on the other side of that door or what the stranger brings into your world. It is, there's a reason we shut ourselves off and want to protect ourselves from all of these eventualities. But the dance between freedom and to be open and yeah, there's like, I guess that's to the relationship with the power that's greater than yourself that you're talking about. Like it's, there's this dance with a power, another, with another, with another.
It's really a dance with the flow of life. We don't, we're not, I'm a Taoist, so we're not in the flow of life. We are battling life. We are resisting life. We are clinging to life, you know? And life just has its own, and as an emerging force, it has its own rhythms, it has its own flow. And the thing we want to do is hang on to the good things. I was just talking to somebody about this to somebody today. Hang on to the good things and push away the quote unquote the bad
Yeah,
things.
like we even know what those are, though,
What I'm
the
trying to
quote
say.
unquote, right? Yeah, like.
That's right. And so we live in a world of contrast where we think that the point is the contrast. It's black or white. It's up or down. It's good or bad. And when you really think about life is just what it is. It's a gift that we have for a finite moment. For a finite moment in the age of the billions and billions of years of the universe, a finite moment. And we struggle so hard with this finite moment. We're just a wisp of a breath.
What is your, this is going to be a bit of a transition, but I want to get some personal, some biographical here. So, what is your earliest memory of when the word work, the concept of work took on meaning in your life?
Oh, that's great. That's a great question. That's a really great question. I don't know. And the reason why I don't know is because I'm like when did I ever just like, we gotta go to work? I, as a person, was lost until I was around 40 some years old because I hated the box I was put in for work. And I kind of liked my work, but I noticed at some point I was disgruntled all the time. My first husband was like, I don't know if you know this, but you're always pissed off about your job. You're always complaining about your job. You're always this. And so, and in life, I've had a million jobs. I've lived in a bunch of different places, right? Because I think it was never about the work itself. It was about finding meaning in something that was important to my becoming. Now, I couldn't have said that at all. This is all wisdom in retrospect. But I quit a lot of jobs because I'm like, nope, this isn't it. Nope, this isn't it. Nope, this isn't it. But it wasn't that I hated work. I just felt like whatever I was doing, that's not it. That's not it.
Well, I think what stands out, so this is like a And even part of the reason I ask the question the way that I do for a lot of folks, I'm going to push you to kind of go back and try to answer that. But like what you're saying is like, you use the term like go to work. And then you realize like, and you said really well, like finding meaning to something that was important to becoming like work. And then you're like, but it wasn't this. And what you were leaving were jobs. And I think that we, part of the like, what's the core thesis of why I started wanting to have this show and these conversations was we have married the term work with job. And I think that's really dangerous because, I walk with a lot of folks that don't have employment because I work with the poor and they need to work. They have a lot to work on. And to think that there's nothing to do because you don't have a job, that there's no work because there's no jobs. And by the way, in a very short amount of time, there may not be any jobs for any of us anyway. Like, hello. There's a lot of these jobs that are going to go away. So our relationship to employment is going to change. But I have an idea. I have like a thesis that our relationship to work as like something more transcendent than job, something bigger than job, is deep and profound. And so when I ask people that, they'll usually say, well, my first job, you know, mom and dad did. And I want to hear those things. But I also think like at the deeper level of like what work is, like where you early on had to try hard, had to sacrifice, had to like put in work. So for a lot of folks, it could be athletic or a music instrument or chores or, you know, I was working for someone's love or, you know, but like pushing you back to those things and trying to push you now to think back a little bit about, and maybe it is helpful to go, well, here's what mom and dad did, or here's what it looked like, you know, growing up and then navigating. But I'm trying to break the frame a little bit from strict employment.
What?
What?
That's what I'm trying to wrap my head around, you know, this conversation, what you just said. So all I can do is just kind of think about this, whatever came up for me when you were talking about this. The first thing that came up that stopped me a little bit from hearing the rest of what you said was the notion that people have to provide food and shelter for their families and themselves. And so to me, so that threw me immediately into Maslow's hierarchy, where we know that the first basic levels are about, you know, having food and shelter, a sense of belonging, all of that, right? And so to me, you know, when I think about work, I think about work as a necessity for survival.
Okay.
I think work in the way that we're looking at work as a calling is certainly a self-actualizing and self-transcending notion. And it won't come about if you haven't taken care of the basic things that are important to you.
Correct.
Considering where you are in your evolution as a person. So some of us have evolved to the point of, well, what's important to me is belonging and to be part of my tribe. I don't ever want to stand out from my tribe. And then some of us are kind of like, yes, and where I am now, I'm searching for meaning and purpose. That's what I work for, meaning and purpose. And I'm really working to transcend my basic, you know, egotistical small self, for example. But until my basic needs are met, then it's all about the job and all of that. So let me say that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because it and this has come up with a few folks too, because there is, and I've wondered if there isn't a way to maybe explore, like, you know, we use the same word in all these places and it's functional, but like it is, you're right. There is the necessity. It is like, it's a privilege to be able to think about work beyond, let's say, toil, that is a necessity to survival. Because I mean, at some very basic level, to live is work. As in to just, to, like you said, to provide for those like food, shelter, security, like that, you know, it takes a lot of work to meet those. And then, And then there's this interesting like concept that I've played with where, or I think I heard, I want to say it was Joseph Campbell one time in an interview talking about Maslow's hierarchy. And I don't know what to make of this, but he said, like, look at these, like these people that have lived these lives that we call heroic. You could look at a Dr. King, you could look at a Gandhi, you could look at, you know, there's so many examples. He's like, they live by something other than this hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Because like, it's this, you know, it's the monk who lit himself on fire in protest of something. It's like the survival and safety and food and sex is clearly not at the base of their pyramid, but it is like a, it's some sort of like liberated state, right? This like, and I've always wondered about that. Like why did we stack these as pyramid? Like that it has to, you get what I'm asking? Like, can we be can something captivate us so that we're, because I know a lot of, let's say even throughout history, a lot of oppressed folks that go without food and shelter and whatever think, well, freedom is more important than food and shelter, freedom for my children, even I can lay my life down for that, you know? Curious if that like stirs any other thoughts, just like wrestling with this concept.
Well, essentially, my answer to everything is yes, no, maybe, I don't know.
I love it.
There are people, I believe we come into the world at a certain level of evolution, and we can continue to evolve, or we can cling to whatever level or stage we're at, right?
Yeah.
So the evolutionary self, I think, has nothing to do with, okay, I don't really know anything, I'm just talking.
Yeah, that's what we're doing here.
I think sometimes
we reserve the right to say stupid stuff. We're open. This is exploratory. We're dancing. We're dancing here.
So I'm wondering about the evolutionary soul who comes into this world, who I feel already has some kind of mission within them that they pursue. And they pursue that past all outward circumstances. And then I also believe that there are souls who come into this world who are meant to wake up society in some way. That's their mission. And so I do believe that there are people who have this, you know, frankly, to tell you the truth, I think all of us have a mission.
Yeah,
frankly. But I don't know that. So depending upon circumstances, we get it or not, right? So it depends on the rest of my life. It depends on what I'm up to. You know, given my life, I was saying this today to people. I wake up, my only prayer in life really these days is thank you. You know, thank you in the first thing in the morning, and thank you at night, and thank you during the day, because the life that I have is not anything that I ever could have predicted from my circumstances, anything. I have become someone other than I didn't even set out to be this person. I wouldn't even known to be this person. It's based on the choices that I've made in life. So, I mean, I grew up poor. I didn't even know we were poor. I kind of knew we were on welfare. We had to eat that government silver can peanut butter. I don't know if you ever had that, but it's like, 10% peanut butter and 90% oil. But anyway, so I kind of had an inkling we weren't doing that great, right?
Yep.
Food certainly informs that, right?
It's
certainly
for sure.
As my good fortune would have it, right, I was able to have opportunities because I was a gifted thinker. And so I was able to have opportunities that you know, got me where, but the opportunities didn't get me where I am, really. It's the choices that I made. Because we can have all the opportunities in the world. It's up to us to be able to see. But I don't know if everybody is cut out that way. I don't know if everybody's meant to see. I don't even know if everybody's right. So back to, you know, some of us in this life can see no way out of suffering and struggle.
I'm really interested in some words you used right there. So I want to kind of like name them to see if we can't unveil. This seems like there's a maybe a position there. So you use like, so as you were talking about like the souls come into this world and you say like they already have a mission, almost as if it was like predetermined or preset. And then he said, like, and some people, I don't know that they're meant to, right? And so I'm interested about that as a position, like say more to articulate that. And then I'll just like preemptively say, and then like, how does that couple to the concept of like, we all have a choice?
Okay. Yep. I'm aware that you don't want dead air. So just,
I'm okay. I'm okay. That they can wait. They can wait.
I'm thinking.
Yep.
In my spiritual awakening, I do have a certain belief that, sorry, people, this can't possibly be my only chance to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a hard time believing that, right? That I got to get it right. And if I don't, I'm going to go to hell. So, but I shouldn't even have brought hell into it. Let me just leave hell out of it. I see that who I am, at least theoretically, I don't know the truth about it. I won't know until I'm on my deathbed and then I'll know for sure. But at least for right now, I see myself as an evolving soul that right now is encased in this body as a personality. But I see myself as an evolving soul. And because of that, I think that I can give myself a little bit more grace to just live life. Just live life and make the choices to become who, you know, consistent with my values and, you know, what I think I have to offer in this world. And not struggle so hard with trying to get it right.
Yeah. No, okay, so that's helpful. The evolving soul piece actually makes sense of that, because it's like the kind of this, whether it's you call it this or not, like some idea of like reincarnation or something, like I have another go at this or something. Like I am coming through stages of my own development in different iterations or something like that. Now, when you said, oh, I shouldn't have said hell. I want to leave hell out of it. I'm actually curious about that. Partly I'll just say, oh, I think that's probably because it's like a certain religious construct that is somewhat even questionable within its own tradition. And yet, there is a way in which, let's just say without any, and I'll just say this before even letting you say to that, like without any, what's the way to say that? Like, metaphysical position about heaven or hell or the ways that we use those ideas. I do think that like, it's interesting, like a lot of the concept of hell is like something really bad and a place of suffering. And like, I think like I could just think a lot of ways that my own decisions over time have created hellish circumstances in my own life and relationships. Right. So I have found myself in hell at times and realized like I navigated myself there through my choices. And so I've always appreciated it as a concept, even if I don't cling to it as some, like, I'm like, God only knows what happens after this. So I don't have no flag to plant there. Right. So I'm open. So, okay, maybe we do it again. And maybe like, I'm like, cool. Probably not that, but the idea that like, I'm going to create some hellish circumstance or even like the way that we avoid people in suffering at some level is because we almost know that it's hell. Like we want to avoid hell. Like we want to avoid death in some way. Anyway, I was just curious about that. Like how that, but I think, yeah, I'll let you speak to that.
I really want to say this because I know that there are certain ways to speak that will invite openness, and certain ways to speak that will close it down.
Yeah.
And so I said, I'm sorry I said that, because the truth of the matter with me is I honor and respect everybody's orientation. I'm not trying to change anybody else's orientation about any of this concept. And
that would turn someone down, shut someone down. Yes.
And I know that people find liberation. People can find liberation through all their paths. So if you're on a spiritual path, strictly religious path, you can find liberation from that. you know, whatever allows you to feel, you know, embraced by life is, to me, is the thing that's important. And so what I believe and what you believe, you know, whoever's listening believes, I'm going to say, and this is what Ken Wilber is an amazing philosopher and thought leader in America. Ken Wilber would say the following thing that we don't get: everybody's right and everybody's wrong. And the reason why we struggle is because we're unable, unwilling to be influenced by thinking of others.
Mm-hmm.
We close it down. So I'm here to say this. I don't know what I'm talking about. I told you that, right? I don't know.
There's it's a healthy dose of agnosticism. It's like, I'm not here trying to figure this out. And I don't know. Ultimately, I'm not going to act like I know. In fact, it seems as if acting like you know creates some pretty dangerous behavior.
I would say that.
Yeah. So like that, I'm going to avoid that.
Yeah, there's not a lot of openness there.
Correct.
There's not a lot of openness there. And like I said, I don't have the answers for anything. It's just, you know, my personal path at this personal time, right? But I want to come back to this thing about, you know, because I know you kind of wanted to ask, even though you didn't, are we predestined, right? Everybody comes to the world.
Oh, well, that's what I was asking about, like you, the already and meant to. Yeah.
But so I want to say, I want to say that everyone comes with a mission, but that doesn't mean that we are predestined to do anything because we have choices about it. This is what I love about the way we are created. And one of the things I really do believe is that our greatest capacity is will, our
Me too.
Will.
Me too.
And, you know, and I think as part of our will, this is why I also say we have the power of choice. That's what will is about. I can choose. So just because I might have come in here with some kind of quote unquote preordained whatever, which I don't believe, right? I do think we have some clues about perhaps what the possible direction of our lives. But I also love, I'm a sci-fi person, I also love the notion that there's like, you know, there's an infinite number of parallel paths we could be on at any moment based on our choices. So
me too. I think that's really right. And yet that's interesting because I'm like, the will as our greatest capacity, I'm on the exact same. I'm like, this is to me like, and why I even think like vocation and work, there's something really important about the decisions we make. Like work at some level to me is what you will struggle for, what you will sacrifice for, what you will invest in. And at some fundamental level, it's like, this is an application of your will by allocation of your time and energy and resources. And so it's like, well, what is it? You know, and then back to like, my life is my message. Yeah. So, well, that's worth figuring out, becoming, doing what it takes, because like you said before, like our actions are actually creating something in us. And it's like, okay, I want to be intentional about what I'm becoming and what I'm building and live and what I'm saying with my life, with this message. And yet there is this concept of like vocation as a word, even the etymology is like a voice is calling. The vocation is there's a calling. So we use the language of calling or mission or vocation. And so it's like there is some implied, like you said before, like we are in partnership with something greater. And that's interesting to me of like both reaching toward like in a direction we choose to go. And then there is something maybe reaching back, calling back in some like that. That image is what comes to mind in the way you're positioning it, I guess. Like there may actually be a voice calling.
Yes.
But it is up to you what you do with that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm going to butcher this quote, but it's just something like the life you want wants you. Just mm-hmm. that what I what was what something's calling me, but it's also, you know, it's coming back to me. Like it's calling me and I'm going towards it. It's following me, I'm going towards it. But, and again, you know, I have the luxury to be able to think this way. I have the luxury to be able to choose, you know, in ways that perhaps are less risky. Although I do think that the process of evolution is a risky business all the time, you know, and what there is to sacrifice. And we all are sacrificing different things. So let me just say this. My sacrifices for towards work are about being the clearest channel for service that I could possibly be, serving the growth, evolution, and soul journey of other people. Leadership development. That's what I'm calling it, leadership development. And so, that's what I have to sacrifice is anything that traps me into a label. I have to sacrifice looking a certain way as an African American woman, talking a certain way as an African American person, fitting in with, the my tribe. I have to sacrifice being polite and nice sometimes because sometimes I have to be edgy, right? I'm so glad I have to, that I get to sacrifice in my work of becoming my best self to contribute at my highest potential. So for me, that's sacrifice. I know when I was married, my husband passed away in 2012, but we had a rough minute there for a second because he was 10 years older than me.
Can you hear me? Froze
And at
up.
the beginning of, yes.
Wait,
Okay.
back up a sec. Just your husband passed in 2012. You froze, and I just missed that.
Okay. That was him. At the beginning of our marriage.
He's like,
No.
that
At the beginning of our marriage, he worked a lot because he developed a cab business and he was doing that. And I wanted to be connected and all huggy and this and let's we are one kind of a thing. And he's like, no, I gotta work. This is what I do. Okay, I had to learn to just allow that to be, right? Even though I saw I had a different vision, I wanted it a certain way. And I was saying he was 10 years older than I. And so he got to the phase of life where he's like, I am done. Because work for him was a job and it was getting harder. And so I am done. And so we should, go off into the sunset and do more fun things. And I'm like, yeah. And I just started this business. And the hardest thing for me to do was to choose to pursue my calling. So in a sense, I sacrificed, if you will, the notion of myself as a good wife. I had to sacrifice all of that to pursue what I thought was the point of my life.
I'm curious about that as a statement. Like that's very interesting. I think you well illustrated what you're saying about sacrifice. But the concept of good wife, and I just it, you can insert so many things, good friend, good student, good employee, like all of these labels or things that we would put on ourselves. Because what ultimately what you're the picture you're painting is that there's something greater, that this other role has to be laid down. And then, but I'm curious about even like the reality. Like, did does that change like the reality of goodness as a wife by embracing authenticity and calling? Like, I'm just curious, like both in like the thing, like what are we saying about those things that we have to sacrifice? And then are those ultimately real? Or is it no, we're actually like, no, I was wasn't a very good wife because I went and did this other stuff.
Great wife. Well, I think I'm a great person. I'm always working on it, right? I'm
There you
always.
go. Yep.
I was the best wife I could possibly be, right?
Good.
That's what I want to say about that.
Good.
But in our society, you don't really hear people say, "Yeah, I just sacrificed that for work," right? Because that's basically what I'm saying. If you look at it like just that,
Yeah, right.
I sacrificed my marriage for work, for my job. And people do this all the time, right? But they lie to themselves
Ah.
and they don't tell the truth that, yeah, this is my choice right now. And I
Yeah.
get it. It's not going to measure up to what you think I should do. And my husband, it didn't measure up to what he thought I should do. And I had to be very gentle about saying, I'm choosing this over here. I'm choosing my calling. I had to be very gentle about that because it sounds horrible.
I yeah, that's really yeah. No, that it does. It can. It's like weird. Like in hindsight, it's like, oh, it also sounds beautiful, but you're right. Relationally, it's like, oh, because what you're talking about is competing values. I have two things I really want. but I stand at a crossroads, and to choose neither of them is wrong, and to choose both of them is impossible.
Mm. So I think we just have to own the choices we make.
Yeah,
it's with
good.
Power. And I was, it's not like I was clueless about it. I deliberately chose, and I continue to deliberately choose the work that I do.
Yeah.
That's what I feel like I'm here for. And when I have like to have, when I like to go kick it with the girls, you know, whatever all that is, right? I don't think so. Not actually. But sometimes people want more from me than I am willing to give to them, because I'm giving it to the reason why I think I'm here. Mm. And I can't do it everywhere. I mean, I know some people say you can have it all. I think that's probably true. I don't think you can have it all at the same time.
Correct.
Right. Correct. I can't. I just have to think. So I'm sure somebody could do it. I can't. I'm choosing not to.
Tell me about some of the choices. Like, let's go back to the biographical piece. So it's like, that was an interesting touch point on that. And you chose this work later on. You weren't right. And then you were like, okay, but he also told you like, well, you're angry about your job before. So those two stories, there's like a journey between those two stories.
Yeah,
I'd like to hear about some of the choices along the way. Like, tell me a little bit of how did you go from there to there?
Wow. That's a good, you know, I'm going to go back to this. Nobody cares about my story, but I'm going to go anyway.
I do.
I got into the world of work. I don't know, when I was 20 or something, I worked for AT&T as an intern, and I really liked corporate work. So I got into the work as a, you know, there, and I had a fantastic job. I was able to participate in some high level management programs and, you know, designed an assessment for them. And, you know, I got to participate. I got a chance to meet Margaret Mead, you know, and during,
wow.
It was very cool. And so I'm like, this is so great. This is it. This is the kind of work I want to do. And then they said, but you know what? You're just an intern and we can't hire you at this job. We're going to have to hire you as an off the street hire. What? You got to be kidding me. And we have two jobs you can come into. You can be a correspondent in shareholder services, or you can go to programming. I'm like, well, I'm not going in to be a computer programmer. So I went to shareholder services. And one of the things I realized when I was in there, they had, I found this great program on creative problem solving. And I really wanted to go to this upper management level type program. And so I asked the company if they would pay for me. And they said, no. You've been here 6 months. No, we're not paying for you to do that. You stay at your desk. And so I had to make a decision. And again, I've made decisions my whole life for what I think makes sense for my life.
Yeah.
I made a decision. I didn't know how I was going to. I said, well, will you pay for, I know you won't pay for the day. Will you pay for me to travel? No, we won't pay anything. No. And so I said, got it. I'll just pay for myself.
Yep.
So I went, I participated in this program, all of that. So, you know, so I'm going to say that was my first leadership act at work, is choosing me. Mm-hmm. And so my entire work life, I've been choosing me, and that makes me look real sketchy on paper.
It does. People are like, I don't know about that one.
Real sketchy. However, from doing that, you know, my boss said, you know, we got to get you out of this department. We think you have a lot of potential. So we're going to put you into the computer programming program, which I was in for 6 weeks. And that's how you get out of the shareholder job, because that was a dead end job, frankly.
That was the other of the two available jobs.
That's right. That's exactly right. So I went into that program and I didn't want to do it. So I didn't do as well as I wanted to, but they're like, you know what though? We see potential. And the thing was, if you don't pass this program, you get to go back. You get to be back downgraded, and everybody can say, well, she just didn't cut it. So, I mean, I wasn't cutting it, but they were like, you have potential. We're going to keep moving you forward. So anyway, I got an AT&T and I was doing that kind of work. And so a lot of my work was, you know, doing IT. So I ended up in IT doing head of IT for an insurance brokerage company. But prior to that, so after I was at AT&T and I'm like, this is not my work. I want to do something else. And I participated in that program, that self-actualization program. And I'm like, I want to go work for them. So I told my mom that I wanted to go work for them. And it's going to be a $20,000 pay cut. And she's like, what? I mean, you know, you're in a corporate world. You're moving up in the world. You know, Black people don't just quit jobs to take low, less money to go do what now? So my mom was very disappointed and really scared, right? So I did do that job for a couple of years. And then I said, nope, this is not the place for me. These people are insane. So
wait, time out. You did what job for a couple of years?
I left my
You
my
took the pay cut.
I took the pay cut and worked for the self-actualization company.
And those people were insane.
They were insane. And I found out being on the inside of things is often very different than being on the outside of things.
Sure.
So I'm like, okay, well, I got to move on. So I left that job and went back to my old job. And the thing that I want to say about that is I left well. And I left, you know, with relationships, and I left on a high note rather than being pissy about, you know, this isn't working out. And so because of that, the company worked with me to place me again, right? So that I did that job for a while. And then I said, I don't want to do this anymore. So I left that job and moved to Montana. I moved to a town of 60 people.
Was there something there you moved for? Or you just...
No, I moved away from something.
Ah.
I was moving away from me.
Oh,
I was moving away from...
But when you got there, were you there?
Well, when I got there, I realized I dragged that heifer with me. What are you doing here? I thought I left here in New Jersey.
Yeah, you ain't supposed to be here.
I'm supposed to be here. So I really went there to figure out how to do sobriety. How do I do this? How do I do this? And I didn't do well the first year because I met all the people that were, you know, not functioning. And they became my friends. And then I eventually found my way, you know, after a year, I found my way into treatment. And then I became a drug and alcohol counselor in aftercare programs, because I always have had potential. So that's one of the things I would say that's gone for me, is I've always been able to think and I've always had potential. And as bad as things were, they were mostly bad on the inside and not as much on the outside. Right. So I was very depressed and struggling and all of that internally. And then after treatment, I went to work for an insurance brokerage company for a very low level. I was so grateful for this job. I was a part-time temporary data entry clerk. And the guy that hired me said, I'm so embarrassed to give you this job because you're actually a manager, you actually know how to do stuff. I'm so embarrassed. And I said, listen, I'm grateful for the opportunity to do anything. I'm grateful. And so that first year, I made enough money because I lived 60 miles away from work. So I commuted 120 miles a day, and I made only enough money to pay for gas.
Whoa.
Yep. Whoa. But here's the thing that's important. I was a surrendered self by then, and I was so grateful just to have something, just to have work. So going back to just to have work, just like I can do something. I'm not just sitting around, just, you know, I don't know, just breathing. I have work, and I made that work meaningful, and I did my job with a lot of, you know, seriousness. And within a month or two, I became the main secretary in the office, the receptionist. And within 6 months, I became the manager, the office manager. So what I learned is, you know, the power of the surrendered self when life takes a turn the way it turns, right? Seriously, and I was very grateful, you know, all along. But I also realized in that job, I was struggling in the job because it really wasn't my job. It really wasn't my work, and it wasn't my job. Okay.
Yep.
So I was doing a lot of number crunching and just barely keeping my head above water and working until 9 o'clock at night, crying when nobody was in the office because I'm like, oh my God, I suck at this. It's so hard. I was getting it done, but the sacrifice was so much that I just realized I couldn't do it. So I hired somebody to come in just temporary. And this woman was so amazing. And I went, oh, this is her work. I could see it. I could see her purpose because of the way she just elegantly and skillfully was able to navigate the whole thing in way less time than I,
Isn't
right?
that
And
interesting?
much higher level of excellence than I. So I went to my boss and said, you know what? Let's give her my job. So it looked like I got demoted. Okay. And I said, we're getting ready to transition over to IT stuff. That's my thing. I'll do it. So I demoted myself. And in that process, I ended up getting transferred to Portland, Oregon from Montana. And then that work became what it was. And I realized after I was there for 7 years, that it was time to move. It's a long story. It's really a long story, but I realized I was on the side of my job as head of IT. I was doing training and development for as a volunteer for another self-actualizing program. And I'm like, wow, this is what I really want to be doing. And I realized that when I was 25, this is what I'm doing now. This is what I really wanted to be doing. But
Yeah, I love
honestly,
that. Yeah.
I did not get there until I was 40, right?
Wow.
So it took a while, it took a minute. And I just had to keep trusting myself and be willing to make the choices to change, to shift my own future, right? So I got hired on as a consultant, doing leadership reinvention work with corporate Fortune 500 company CEOs and executive teams.
Say that again, leaders. What is it again?
Leadership reinvention.
Reinvention. Can
Yeah,
you
leadership
say a
reinvention.
few words for definition
Yeah,
purposes?
so in other words, so for some of the, I don't want to name the companies, but really they were like Fortune 50 companies, a couple of those. These were large scale change events where the leaders said, we have got to change our sense of credibility in our organizations because the people are no longer following us and we've made lots of mistakes. And so our work as consultants was to work with the executives in a way that they became more human and they stopped being I'm an executive and they became more human. And in that process, they started telling the truth, being more vulnerable, having more courage, letting down some of the walls. And so that was our work was like, how do you reinvent the story of who you are in an organization in which everyone has you trapped in a story, in a narrative? You got that?
I do. Yes, and it's so intriguing. So intriguing. And this is when you started doing that?
This was in the 90s, 19, like 91.
Okay. Yep.
And then in 98, I started my own business. But I started my own business, which is what I do today, Wide Awake. And my work is really about having people be more awake about the choices that they make in life and to grow up to actually really look at what's important and how do I reorient my life around that. But I started my business with, so the thing I want to talk about are some of the internal conversations we have as people and whether or not we use those conversations to stop ourselves or support or empower ourselves. And at the time that I started my business, really, because I got laid off, okay, because I got laid off because I didn't want to do what the company was doing.
That's when you started your business was like, oh, I got laid off from the leadership reinvention work.
Yeah, I got
Got
laid
it.
off. Because
Got it.
the company changed their mission, and I wasn't aligned with that. And I didn't really know all of this at the time, but I kept doing what I wanted to do, which was developing coaching capacities in the consulting group that was part of another company inside internally. I was doing a lot of internal work.
You seem naturally gifted at doing what you want to do
So
throughout the story.
gifted at it.
I'm
So
so gifted. I'm gonna do what I want. I do what I want.
So gifted at it. So but there's a price. I got laid off.
Good. Not good, but got it.
It was good.
And maybe good, yep. Because this is the launch of your own company.
My own business. On top of a conversation that said this, girl, please, I don't know why you're starting your own business. You're only going to watch TV all day long. You're going to sit on the couch and eat bonbons all day long. You don't have any discipline. I don't know why you are doing this. You're crazy. That was my conversation.
That conversation was from the company you were leaving or from close?
That was my conversation.
This is the internal conversation.
This is my internal conversation. Yeah.
Well, you're a jerk. Okay. I was like, who said that?
I said this.
Okay.
I said, you are not the kind of person who should have her own business. Really, girl. You're not going to network. You're painfully introverted. You're not going to do this. And I'm like, I can't help it. I can't help it. This is what I'm going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made that happen. And I've been in business since 2000.
So I'm curious, like, I'm just thinking about folks listening and relating to the internal conversation. Can we stay on that for a little bit, just for the sake of everybody? Like, say more about, like, I mean, obviously I know this is probably something you do with folks you work with a lot, because this is a reality of, like, look, you need to, like, I love the wake up. It's like wide awake. It's like, wake up. Do you see what's the story you're telling yourself right now? Right. And then how do you navigate when you recognize you're having that dialogue, that it even is existing? And then how are you navigating that? I know it's a reality for everyone and it takes real work.
It is. Remember, yes, no, maybe, I don't know. I can say this. I do think that within us, we have a, what do I want to call it? A navigation system. We're either paying attention to it or we're suppressing it. And so what I've learned about from working with people is that most of the people I know have a real clear sense of this isn't it, right? Now, they may not know what the next thing is. So you'll notice that, you know, in my journey, I navigated from I don't know to I don't know to I don't know to I don't know. But it really was a navigation of no, not this. This isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. And so we have people have high tolerance for living lives that isn't it.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's always something within us that tells us this isn't it. And so how do you pay attention? And that this really is it. You've got to empower your ability to trust that and to know, and you never really do know, that you're gonna be all right if you go, this isn't it, let me go to the next thing. And I never knew what the next thing was, right? Not necessarily. I never really knew what the next thing was. I would go for something. And so the other mistake I think people make is trying to find the thing. Let me do the thing. Let me find the thing. And because you can't think of the thing, then we stay in our space. What I've learned is this. You can't ever see what's next. From the chair that you're sitting in, you have to take a step.
Yeah.
It's only when you take a step that you can start to see something else emerging. But most of the time, we don't take the step. We just sit and wonder. This sort of didn't answer your question. But.
No, well, it does. Okay, here, let me see how what you said makes sense around this. Because, so one, you're saying, hey, I think we all have a bit of a navigation system. I think that's really interesting. I'm curious, like, what we would even call that, but we have something like that, whether it's intuition, conscience, we have something going on that's going, this isn't it. By the way, what a quote. We have a high tolerance for living a life that isn't it. I'm like, man, that's just a banger. But then there's this, and then I'm thinking, like, as you're saying that, well, like, you knew it wasn't it. It wasn't it. And then in your own story, I wanted to interrupt, but I'm glad I didn't. Like, your own story was, it isn't it. This isn't it. This isn't it. And then you went, oh, this is it. Oh, these people are nuts. This isn't it. So that was interesting to me because it wasn't what, it was who. And that's something I think is a very, you know, a lot of people like, because I actually think for some people, who is a more important question sometimes, like where it's like, maybe there's a tribe you're supposed to be with and what they're doing is what you will be doing because you're with, you belong.
That's really good.
You know, and then maybe there is a what and who isn't as important in this. Like I don't know that we all want to know what do I want to do, but we don't ask who am I supposed to do something with, where that person might be right with us or near us or something like that. And you were like, this is it. But then you went, no, they're crazy. And then it isn't it. And so you went, not it, not it, not it. But the beauty of that was I always took that next step. You said, well, that helps me to see something emerge. I said, how do people navigate this? You're answering it because you're like, well, you have a thing. You need to listen to it. And you need to move when it's not it. And don't tolerate living a life that's not it. But then, oh, by the way, warning, if you think I got to find the thing, and you're right, this is such a plague on people. Like when you use words like calling, like, man, well, what's my calling? I don't know what my calling is. So I'm going to sit here until I like a burning bush or I hear from God or something that tells me like, do this specific thing. And so they do nothing.
Yeah,
they do nothing. And which is a decision. It's a decision to not make any decisions, and it's a paralysis, like a place where it's like, well, then I just stand at the crossroads.
It is. And honestly, I have to tell you, you know, I talk to people, I've talked to thousands of people, but half the time when I'm talking with them and, you know, I tell them, you know, the possibilities, it rather than them being able to really try on the possibility as a reflection, as an introspection, as an examination, they go immediately, how do I do that? And I'm like, okay, so first of all.
And they sound just like that too.
I mean, they do sound just like that. Like there's this urgency. That's right. There's an urgency to quote unquote get somewhere when the process of life is becoming the self that takes you somewhere.
Journey over destination.
Yeah.
I always joke, you know, the GPS used to say, it doesn't anymore, but they used to go, you have arrived. And I'm like, always remind yourself, you haven't, you have not. You just got here. That's it. Okay. Oh, that's interesting though. Like the, you say it's hard for some. So one, I wasn't anticipating the point being what it was. So that they want to get there, not journey there. So check, I got it. And there's something really important about that. And so part of the internal conversation or the thing where you were saying about that navigation system is like, it may take some time. Like it's different steps of not it, not it, not it. You got to try all the stuff at the buffet before you know what you want to fill your plate with or something like that.
I just want to say that is a journey that some of us are on. You know, so I hearken back to when I went to college. Oh my God, I was a hot mess. But when I went to college, I remember two people. One of the people wanted to be a doctor. The other wanted to be, you know, an attorney. And guess what? They did that, right? Yeah. And I'm like, geez, how the hell does that happen? Because I was clueless. So I tried, you know, I took some law courses. That's not it. I took some math and science courses. And that really wasn't it. You know, and then I stumbled into, well, what's left? I stumbled into psychology and sociology. And I'm like, oh, okay. This is kind of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's things along the way. It's kind of like a Hansel and Gretel life. There's little breadcrumbs along the way that they go, huh, this is kind of it. But then I had to think about that, right? I didn't want to sit around and listen to people talk about their problems for years and years and never make any changes. So I couldn't be a psychologist like that, right?
Right. So I think that, no, because like psychology is super fascinating, except for the part where it's so past oriented and not future oriented. It's like, all right, okay, cool. Yeah. It's been hard out here. I get it. It's been hard, but like tonight, like, what about tonight? What about next? What about when we leave? Like,
and clearly there's a need for it. I mean, I've had lots of therapists, so there was a need.
I'm not in, by the way, I think we should all be spending some time. Right. Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
But being in the chair that's doing it, I can imagine being a frustrating thing. But like, I thought we were going to do something about that.
So.
What do you think? I have a, I'm not going to tell you what I think it is, but I'm going to test the philosophy I have on you because I feel so aligned on some stuff. So with Will as this centerpiece kind of great capacity of our lives. So I would say, well, here's like the, I'm like, humans are made to be free. And even as you talk about finding, when you talk about all these different paths, you're like, they can find liberation. I'm like, right. To be what? To be human, to be free, to be, and at the heart of that is will, right? It's our, it's the great gift. It's the great capacity of mankind. And I'm like, all right, I think we're on this exact same page there. So then what is it that erodes our will? So because there is, there just as phenomenologically, there are people who seem to lack it. Like at like power, maybe not in some fundamental way, but like the muscle has atrophied or something like that. You get what I'm asking, right?
I do. Life is hard.
Yeah.
What erodes will? Life is hard. And this is why I'm grateful every day. I could have been that eroded will. I was beat down in that way.
Yep.
Where it looked like I was powerless.
Yep.
Because I was.
Yeah.
So I think that there is, for some of us, there are opportunities and ways out. And I think for some of us, there doesn't seem to be.
That's right. Which when I encounter like something like what I guess is clinical depression, it, at some level, what it looks like to me is like a will, a sickness of will, like genuine sickness. Like, it's like, well, I can't get out of bed.
Right.
Right. And like, well, what do you need to do to be better?
Yes.
Stand up, get in the sun, like some action
sure.
needs to be taken at whatever level you're at. Like, let's not set the bar somewhere you can't achieve, but it is like there is like some battle of will is taking place. And even when you talked about the kind of liberation piece, there's this language of surrender. But on that end, I feel like there's language of surrender as well. Like we almost surrender to futility, captivity, something like that. Like it's almost like a, I don't know, especially among like folks we work with that are like, you know, people in destitute poverty will often think, well, it's what I, almost like a predestination, like it's what I deserve or it's what I'm made for or all I'm good for or whatever. Like what I've come to think of as like ontological poverty, like it's poverty that moved, like found a home in your heart and mind.
Oh yeah. Yes. So in those circumstances, one thing I don't do as a coach is try to fix people. First of all, I don't think that people are broken, even those who are really, as you said, like clinical depression and all of that. I don't consider that they're broken. I consider that this is the hand they've been dealt. This is the hand they've been dealt. And I think, and, you know, for myself, all I can do is have compassion for that and gratitude that I don't have that. That's not a thing for me. As opposed to try to change them or fix them or act like that's not okay or to be intolerant or, you know, one of the things I had to learn for myself as an African American is, look, everybody has, all African Americans have not had my opportunities. I'm fortunate enough to be able to feel like I can navigate life actually without feeling like my life is in danger. Now, it probably is, but that's not how I'm looking at it. So I'm not paying any attention to that, but I'm very well aware that at any moment, one thing I never forget is that I'm African-American. I don't care how much education or money I have, I'm African-American. Any hard thing that happens to all of us can happen to me, right? That's a journey because early on as an intellectual with opportunities and, you know, educational opportunities, I'm like, I don't understand why people just don't pick themselves up and, you know, what an ass, right?
Right.
So, you know, I've had to learn, you know, that I have been especially blessed I'll say that.
When part of that is, and you've referenced it several times, like I've always been able to think. Yes. Like just at some level, like IQ and temperament is a gift of DNA, like that it is what it is, right? Yes. Circumstances aside, like you have a real gift to think.
Yes. Yes.
And a lot of people don't.
And a lot of
all
people
walks don't. Of life. Yep. It's just like we are diverse in that way as well.
That's exactly right. So yeah. So it's a journey. Life is a journey. And we're all hitting it and having it in many different ways, right?
What do you I imagine through a lot of the since you coach with professionals, and leaders and stuff. So my guess is, and we don't need to like hang on the depression piece, but my guess is like there's like that's someone's gonna go to like psychiatry or like where and then but then you're like, and not to say there's not leaders that are in like desperate need of that, but like also these are like very driven, active people that you're like dealing at. They're not people that are wasted wills necessarily, like wasting away what I mean, wills. People with willpower that are determined and after getting after something and help trying to like navigate that with sobriety and health and authenticity. And I'm curious about the role of, so I guess this is maybe asking you to speak a little on like general, like rhythms of life in relationship to work, but like things like rest, like leisure, like the rhythm of stopping, like in a relationship with work. I'm just curious, like, because I imagine you have quite the sampling, like I'm jealous for the sampling of leaders that you have to draw from, right? People that you've had to talk to, like at length, like we're doing. And I'm kind of curious about like, what are the things that you see that emerge as patterns? Like, oh, you know what? Like something we really need to be thinking about in like a healthy life, a healthy vocational engagement. Is, yeah, curious if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yes, yeah, that's great. Phew, there's a million things I want to say. Where do I start? I see a lot of burnout these days, to tell you the truth, and COVID didn't help. COVID created, in my mind, the way in which people beed during COVID was in a way that they didn't emerge necessarily with a great sense of resilience, right? This is a place of powerlessness. And, you know, if you are a person who has been able to control their environment and groups and people and organizations, now you are stuck at home with your wife and kids. This is a terrible way to put it. But, you know, who you were, who your identity, you can't do that now with COVID, right? Or I found a lot of people who, like superintendents in particular, who had to keep going to work and battling boards of directors who were beating them up because, you know, there were hard choices to make. Do we stay open?
Right. Close? Yeah, I couldn't imagine having to navigate all of those that. Systems.
So they were really, really beat up in some cases, in a lot of cases. So what I saw was just people really just beleaguered by all of the slings and arrows that they had to wear on a daily basis, trying to figure out how to navigate the whole COVID experience. And so I think a lot of them are still trying to recover from that. And so I want to say that, I'll put that over there. Mm-hmm. Years and years ago when I went through treatment, I saw this great talk by Dr. Father Martin, who said, for those of us who are in helping professions, you should never, ever, ever burn out. There's no such thing as burnout. If you're burnt out, you're not doing it right, basically. Mm-hmm. This is my paraphrase. He would never say that. He was a Catholic priest. He said it nicely. Maybe, right? And so so I think there's this notion, what I see is that people are really, and I'm still thinking about this a lot, the distinction between service and servitude. Because when I see people who are burdened, it's because I think they are providing service in a way in which they are burdened by the choices that they've made to be of service in the way they're going about it. So that was a lot of words. So in other words, you know,
there we go. Other words. Yep.
So servitude to me looks like I'm going to sacrifice everything that I have and everything that I am in order to give to you, even when I don't have it to give.
Yeah.
There's a book. What's the name of the book? Overwhelmed. Burnt. I think it's called Burnout, but I don't remember. By two sisters, who labeled the term the human giver syndrome. We give and give and give until we have nothing to give, and then we give and give and give some more. And to me, that's servitude. And the reason why that happens is because we have this notion that it's a high-minded way of being. That's service, right? Service is you sacrifice yourself. You eat yourself alive and, you know, for somebody else or for some other thing. It's a high-minded thing, but for some other thing.
Yeah. And
I say that service is that which serves. I have a lot of words. Service is that which serves the totality of what is meant by service, meaning this. If the service that I'm providing is not also serving me, it's really not serving what is meant by service, because service, in my mind, should serve me, should serve you, and should serve the thing that we are aligned, that we're moving towards. Mm. Right? So if I'm not living my life in a way that I'm also being served by the way in which I am providing service, then I am never going to make it. I'm going to be exhausted, burdened, resentful.
You know, that's something we see a lot in the work we do with, you know, we serve folks that live on the streets. Like, we run these free markets, and we have a lot of people that'll come to volunteer, and many who will do so over a long period of time, some of whom have not just volunteered, but been employed by us. And I've seen a lot of burnout over the years, and this is actually interesting to reflect on, because I've puzzled over it a lot, like, and just thought, well, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm temperamentally lucky. Maybe it's because I hit my head in a car accident. Maybe that's true. But also, like, I wonder, you know, this is interesting, like, if you're familiar with, like, the, you're familiar with the Big Five, like the ocean kind of thing. Doesn't matter, but it's a temperamental scale. Like, you can take these, it's kind of like a personality profile, but it's more on temperament. but I actually rank quite low in the C, which is not conscientious, is actually quite high. What is it? OCEA, agreeableness. So agreeableness breaks down into two categories, which is compassion and politeness. And I'm off the chain. I'm off the charts low in both of those. And I actually think that might be a gift. Now, it's often not, because I can be quite rude and whatever, but being disagreeable in this vocation can be a real gift, because what I've realized is a lot of people that are driven to work with us are driven by compassion. And as you broke out servitude, the word that stood out to me was like burdened, like almost driven by like guilt or shame or penance. And maybe they would never say that, but I have thought maybe that's because I see, like, the same compassion that brought you here to, like, care for these poor people is the same thing that makes you take the shirt off your own back and give what you don't have to give, and then come and, like, die, which at some level isn't a real service ultimately, because one, typically those relationships aren't good for either of the people involved. But also, like, just observation, watching people go, that's not good for either of you. And then also, you're gone now.
That's
like,
right.
It doesn't serve the system. Like, we can't endure and have food tomorrow now, or food next year, because of we gave it all up today. We gave up the ghost today. That human giver syndrome, I never heard that. I want to look that book up, but that actually resonates. Like, as you're describing the servitude, I'm like, I haven't heard those two words put by each other, but man, does it not. And what is servitude? But, like, even if you just took the word apart from this conversation, what is servitude? You're like, it's like akin to, you know,
it's akin,
like,
to slavery.
Like mild slavery or lack of freedom, or like, it is not an act of freedom.
No, it is not an act of freedom and contribution. No.
Yeah, it's like you talked about like handcuffs. It's like servitude is like a chain gang. That's what servitude looks like, at least when the word conjures. It's so powerful.
And that's what people think. I mean, we've sort of been taught this, right? The holy person is completely and wholly self-sacrificing, right? We've been taught this. And so I get how people can get this confused, right? But I'm going to say this, that really what's the problem is going circling back, because I know our time is coming to a close, but circling back to, I believe it's a confusion of identity. I am not what I do. I am good. who I be. Now in that, then I get to do from that place, right? But I also get to choose how to be in a way that I'm never working from a place of depletion.
Yeah. So can you like double click on that who I be? I think I get what you're saying in terms of like, it's not what we do, but who we are. Like, we're human beings, not human doings or something like that. Right. Like, that's what you're like. There is some sense of like identity and presence and being and a way in which we are. And then out of that, we can do. Is that, but I wanted to like have you kind of like say a little bit more around that.
Oh, I think you said it very well.
Okay. Well, I wanted to make sure that I'm glad I said it back, because I was like, I wanted to get clarity.
I also wanted to say, I saw a clip from Brené Brown the other day where she was talking about some research that she did on compassion. And she said, across all the things that she's done, she said she thought compassion would be like a spiritual thing. And she wasn't sure what people would, what she would find in her research. And one of the things she found is this: people who are compassionate because they have boundaries. I'm like, what? What does that mean? It means that in my desire to be of service and to be an actor in serving you, I have to be able to create sufficient boundaries so that the you get is me, not some notion that I am what I do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when we are depleted, all we're doing is going through the motions, because that's what good people do. You see what I'm saying? So we're identified. That's what good people, I'm just going to keep doing this. Forget about what's happening over here. I'm just going to give it all away. Right. Compassionate people have boundaries that also include themselves. So they have a sense of vulnerability and self-compassion as well.
You know, that's interesting. The way I was using compassion as a temperament, I would say, is different than the way it's being used here, which is probably maybe a higher, like a more true, healthy state of compassion versus like some like temperamental state. And here's what came to mind. There was a girl from, she's a college student, young girl, volunteering at our free market. So we call it the Kinship, and we have a nice table. We set up like a farmer's market, and there's nice vegetables and all this. And there's a bunch of people that come to get food, but we don't want them all like rushing the table, because that wouldn't be very dignifying and wouldn't give people space. So I say to her, hey, three people at a time, like have three people up. And when the first person like checks out and leaves, like we weigh them out on one side, when they're done, you can call up one more person. So at the table, there's plenty of room for three people to not be jammed up and like, and you know, don't have more than three. So, but I like to like empower them and float around and then kind of come back. And so I come back and there's like six people at the table and they're all like brustled up against each other. And I went over to her and I was like, cause she was the gatekeeper, right? She was the one holding the bags and welcoming people in. I said, hey, what happened? Like, there's like six people here. Look how terrible. Look like the table doesn't look very, this doesn't look like a good shopping experience. And she said, well, you know, those ladies just came up and they just started going. And I said, but like, why didn't you tell them like to wait their turn? And she said, well, I didn't want to be rude. And I was like, well, you definitely shouldn't be rude. You shouldn't be rude, but you should definitely tell them like that, what the boundaries are. right? Like respectfully, kindly, with love and dignity, but like, hey, there's a way we're going to go about this for the sake of everybody here. It would serve the whole. And it hit me, and this has actually been like driven home for me, but I started really like taking the word nice. Like I realized like this is like a feature of nice, which we also like couple with compassionate. And I'm like, nice is not a virtue. Kindness is, but it's a different thing. It's like, be kind and hold this boundary. But that niceness, it's almost like I can't even say what's true or what's needed. And it was just like, I walked away from this interaction with a student and I just had a brief exchange. But I said, hey, I need you to do this. Like, just if it's just do what I say right now, but like, you're not doing anyone any favors this way. And like, and I just did oh, by the way, this probably is true in all of your relationships, like throughout all of your life, right? Like you need to say like, hey, it's not your turn yet or whatever. Like, and yeah. Anyway, that's the first memory that came to mind as you were saying that.
Great. When you were talking about nice and kind, I love your distinction. I heard nice is like a social construct. You know, people tell you what nice looks like and sounds like, whereas kind possibly is a spiritual orientation to our community, right? That's way different than nice.
Way different. I've actually seen examples where, you know, someone was violating, like, let's say a bunch of social norms or whatever, like someone's just doesn't read social cues and is doing like a terrible job and like upsetting everybody, but like no one will say to them like, hey, you're missing some cues here. And so a kind friend will pull them aside and say, you're messing up completely in all these places, and will say something very hard. Yes. Like, you know, no one likes being around you, right? And you know why? It's really clear. Like, they're telling you all the time, you're just missing it. And yes. And that would take a real act of kindness, love even, but it's not a nice thing to say to someone.
No, it's not. Although I suppose people can be kind and nice. I don't know that I've, you know, really mastered that one, but.
Sure. Yeah, I wonder. Well, I really love that you brought this back to identity. I think at some very basic level, it is like, I love that this journey, this work that we've talked about throughout this, the journey of this conversation even really started and ended with really like that question that I asked you when we started, like, introduce yourself, like, who are you? And at some level it's like, well, who am I becoming? Who have I been? And like, where am I going? And like that, all of this has been, I don't know, a way to like navigate around that deepest of questions. And hopefully for those listening, has been a bit of an exploration in that as well. I imagine a few people listening would love to reach out to you or get in touch with you to hear like, yo, this is something I could really use in my life. Like, and it turns out that's what you do. Right. So, how can people get in touch with you? Is there some way, is there a website? Is there some social media place that people could reach out or learn more about you?
Yeah. So, I started with saying that I'm an introverted, I'm a reclusive introvert. So I'm not hanging out on social media a whole lot, but somebody did.
You don't have a TikTok? I can't come watch you dance on TikTok. Come on now.
But I have a website, sandybrown.com, sandybrown.com. Persist, because my homepage is broken, but persist. And you will get further along in the website.
Persist for sure. And the woman is in demand. So you might have to plan ahead a little bit, but definitely worth doing. And Sandy, thank you so much for spending this time with me. Thank you for sharing your story. And I'm just grateful. I'm grateful to know you, but also I'm just always like, so want to celebrate the people that do what they want. And I love that about you.
One of those. I was honored that you asked. Really honored. And I don't say yes to a lot of things as you might imagine, unless I want to.
The reclusive introvert. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And
that's right, unless I really want to.
And I don't want to. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I just feel really connected to you and the work that you're doing in the world and the way in which you're going about life in a thoughtful and reflective way. And understanding that part of the journey is about who you be and who you become and how that unfolds, right?
So we try. I don't know if you heard me say this, but I always joke my communal tombstone or our communal tombstone as an entity will be they tried.
That's right.
But I'm pretty happy with that. I'm pretty happy with that.
That's right. That's right. It says a lot, actually.
That's good.
Love you, man.
Thank you.
You too. Bye.